Hello and welcome. Recent public opinion polls show a high level of dissatisfaction with the U.S. involvement in Iraq and Afghanistan, and a rejection by most Americans of the legacy of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. There's a great deal of sentiment by Americans for a less global role in the world and a reduction of U.S. military presence around the world. But this is not reflected in the policies of both Democratic and Republican presidents in recent years, and the leading Republican candidates for the presidency are pledged to continuing a U.S. role of a global military presence around the world. This apparent compulsion to act as the world's policeman, to impose by force a special, exceptionalist American vision of how other societies should be organized and governed, is, of course, nothing new. It's been in place, well entrenched, in American history and in policy for more than a century. Until the end of the 19th century, Americans overwhelmingly rejected global adventurism. And until the 1890s, America followed a traditionalist foreign policy of non-intervention. This was laid out very early on in U.S. history by George Washington and by other early American leaders, and by Washington, of course, in his famous farewell address of 1796, which he wrote with the help of James Madison and Alexander Hamilton. And this farewell address was a cornerstone of U.S. foreign policy for more than a century. In the farewell address, Washington urged Americans to, as he put it, and I'm quoting, observe good faith and justice towards all nations, cultivate peace and harmony with all. Now, in saying that, he didn't mean cultivate good faith and justice toward all nations and cultivate peace only with those that were European or Christian or that had a Republican or Democratic form of government. He urged the United States to cultivate good faith and justice and peace and harmony even with governments that had forms of government very different than those of the United States. He went on, a passionate attachment of one nation for another produces a variety of evils. Sympathy for the favorite nation, facilitating the illusion of an imaginary common interest in cases where no real common interest exists, and infusing into one the enmities of the other, betrays the former into a participation in the quarrels and wars of the latter without adequate inducement or justification. He went on, such attachments, that is, these passionate attachments to other countries, are particularly alarming to the truly enlightened and independent patriot. And he warned against what he called the insidious wiles of foreign influence. And he said that the jealousy of a free people, that Americans ought to be constantly awake toward the dangers of foreign influence. And he said that foreign influence is one of the most baneful foes of Republican government. The great rule of conduct for us in regard to foreign nations, he wrote, is in extending our commercial relations to have with them as little political connection as possible. It is our true policy to steer clear of permanent alliances with any portion of the foreign world. The duty of holding a neutral conduct may be inferred without anything more from the obligation which justice and humanity impose on every nation. Now, this common sense outlook on U.S. foreign policy was the prevailing one until the late 1890s. It was also laid out by John Quincy Adams, who was not only a president of the United States, but also served as U.S. Secretary of State and was also a member of the House of Representatives. In 1821, John Quincy Adams admonished and issued this statement saying that U.S. foreign policy should again be one of non-intervention in other countries, even when the United States may be sympathetic to the goals and the feelings of people in other countries. He wrote, "Wherever the standard of freedom and independence has been or shall be unfurled, there will be her, that is, America's heart, her benedictions, and her prayers. But she goes not abroad in search of monsters to destroy. America," he wrote, "is the well-wisher to the freedom and independence of all, but she is the champion and vindicator only of her own. She well knows that by once enlisting under other banners than her own, were they even the banners of foreign independence, she would involve herself beyond the power of extrication in all the wars of interest and intrigue, of individual avarice, envy, and ambition, which assume the colors and usurp the standard of freedom." He warned that America, as he put it, might become the dictatress of the world. She would then no longer be the ruler of her own spirit. Adams finally concluded, "America's glory is not dominion but liberty. Her march is the march of the mind. The motto on her shield is freedom, independence, and peace." Now, both Adams and Washington and other Americans warned that even if America was sympathetic to the independence of other countries, the United States should avoid becoming militarily involved or even politically involved with other nations, that America could retain its own legacy of freedom and independence, prosperity, and so forth, only by staying aloof from foreign involvement. Well, that began to change at the end of the 19th century. From the end of the Civil War in 1865 up until the end of the 19th century, America was not involved in any foreign conflicts. It had no troops overseas. It didn't involve itself in other foreign adventures or so forth. And that's what most Americans wanted. And that was consistent, again, with the policy laid out by Washington, Hamilton, Madison, Adams, and so forth. But this began changing for a number of reasons. One of them was commercial. America, by 1898, had become a very major industrial power and a very important financial commercial factor in the world. As the 1890s began, Americans were looked upon with satisfaction that it had been not involved in any foreign wars, in fact, since 1848. And it maintained, as a result of that, only a very small military force. Some questioned the need for even its most minimal foreign ties. Some people said the United States didn't even need a U.S. State Department because our involvement with foreign countries was so and should be very, very minimal. But because the United States had become a leading agricultural and industrial power, along with its status as an economic force, the United States found itself able to compete also militarily in the international arena with other great powers. It had the economic power to back up foreign expansion or imperialism if it wished. Many farmers and manufacturers in the United States began looking more eagerly to foreign markets to absorb growing surpluses. And a small number of Americans pleaded and wished that America should follow the example of rival European powers in the imperialist scramble for colonies, especially in Asia, Africa, and so forth. One American periodical wrote in 1898, "The subjugation of a continent, that is, here in North America, was sufficient to keep the American people busy at home for a century. But now that the continent is subdued, we are looking for fresh worlds to conquer." In this setting came the greatest challenge up to that time for the principles that had guided the conduct of American foreign policy since its beginning. And that was with the Spanish-American War of 1898. This was a crucial, critical departure from traditional foreign policy. And it meant a landmark shift from the United States focusing on its own internal affairs to being one involved deeply in other countries' affairs. The Spanish-American War is worth looking at in detail because of the lessons it shows us about U.S. foreign policy and U.S. involvement in other wars throughout the 20th century and up into our own time. The Spanish-American War did not begin spontaneously. As happened in other critical occasions in U.S. history, the media played an important and probably crucial role in rousing public sentiment for war. And that, again, points up the dangers of a mass democracy which appeals to emotion and sentiment, also something that was warned against by Washington, Hamilton, and others, American leaders, at the beginning of American history. In particular, in New York City, two major daily newspapers, the New York Journal, owned by William Randolph Hearst, and the New York World, run by Joseph Pulitzer, had already been doing everything possible to inflame bellicose and adventurous passions with embellished stories of supposed Spanish barbarism in Cuba, which was at that time a Spanish colony. By 1898, each of these two major newspapers, which were referred to as the Yellow Press, these two rivals, were selling more than 800,000 newspapers a day. Now, this is in the pre-television, pre-radio, pre-internet age, and so the newspapers were the major vehicle for both influencing and reflecting public opinion and shaping public opinion. Other imitators of these two highly sensational and large circulation newspapers had arisen, had sprung up in other major American cities, Chicago, San Francisco, and so forth. In response to the unrest and agitation in the United States about Cuba, in early 1898, President McKinley sent the U.S. warship Maine to Havana Harbor in Cuba. While the U.S. government announced that the mission of the U.S. Maine was a friendly act of courtesy, supposedly, everyone knew that this was really part of a provocation. Its real mission, its major mission, was to protect American life and property if and when Cuban revolutionaries took control of the Cuban capital, Havana. On the evening of February 15, 1898, a mysterious explosion suddenly blew up the Maine while it was resting at anchor in the harbor, killing 260 Navy servicemen. Without a shred of real evidence, the New York World and the New York Journal and other prominent American newspapers and prominent individuals, and especially politicians, immediately blamed Spanish authorities for the disaster. Even though Spain had no rational motive whatsoever for provoking the United States, and no evidence of Spanish guilt has ever come to light. But in spite of that, the incident was instantly seized upon to inflame passions for war. Headlines in the New York Journal, the Hearst newspaper, told readers that, quote, destruction of the warship Maine was the work of an enemy. And it reported that Assistant Secretary Roosevelt, that is Theodore Roosevelt, Assistant Secretary of the Navy, was convinced that the explosion of the ship was not an accident. The newspaper also declared that Navy officers think the Maine was destroyed by a Spanish mine. And the Hearst Journal would later shamelessly take credit for the Spanish-American War itself. Not to be outdone, the New York World, run by Joseph Pulitzer, branded the explosion of the Maine an act of war and declared that the destruction of the Maine by foul play should be the occasion of ordering our fleet to Havana. If Spain will not punish her miscreants, we must punish Spain. And 10 days later, the New York World declared, "Stop the nonsense, stop the trifling, let us have peace even at the muzzle of our guns." Even supposedly responsible voices joined in the national frenzy. One Presbyterian journal declared, "And if it be the will of Almighty God that by war the last trace of this inhumanity of man," that is referring to Spain, "shall be swept away from this Western Hemisphere, let it come." A rallying cry quickly caught fire across the United States, the cry, "Remember the Maine, to hell with Spain." Now, one of the most interesting aspects of this is that the media treatment of the Maine incident foreshadowed similar cases at other pivotal times in U.S. history, including the highly misleading and inflammatory U.S. press coverage of the German submarine sinking in May 1915 of the liner Lusitania, and the Gulf of Tonkin attack in August of 1964, which was misrepresented by President Johnson to secure blank check congressional authorization for unlimited war in Southeast Asia. Also, in the same spirit were fake atrocity stories that helped incite public support for the first Gulf War against Iraq under the presidency of George H.W. Bush. Predictably, the hysteria that swept the country was reflected in the U.S. Congress, where lawmakers shouted at each other and ran up and down the aisles like madmen. One U.S. representative said that every congressman had two or three newspapers in his district, most of them printed in red ink and shouting for blood. Senator Allen accused Spain of what he called wholesale murder in the Maine explosion, while in the lobby, war-hungry congressmen sang the Battle Hymn of the Republic and other bellicose songs. One representative, Representative McDowell, demanded, as in his words, "these murderous, treacherous, bullfighting Spanish hyenas should be made to get off the Western Hemisphere," unquote. Well, in this crazed atmosphere, anyone who raised a voice to protest risked being labeled unpatriotic. A professor at Harvard University, Charles Elliott Norton, a well-known scholar of fine arts, was denounced by the press as a traitor because he opposed war with Spain. And a Boston politician proposed that Professor Norton be lynched. Distressed by the mounting concern and criticism that he was soft, President McKinley, on April 11, 1898, asked Congress for authorization to expel Spanish forces from Cuba. In his address, he called for this, quote, "in the name of humanity, in the name of civilization, in behalf of endangered American interests." Well, Congress promptly complied, and on April 25th, and then on April 25th, it passed another resolution declaring war to exist in fact and directing President McKinley to employ land and naval forces to wage it. And the Spanish-American War was underway. In the Far East, a U.S. fleet under Admiral George Dewey steamed into Manila Harbor in the Philippines on May 1st, where it quickly destroyed the Spanish fleet there. And after a short effort that Theodore Roosevelt called a splendid little war, U.S. forces quickly subdued Spanish forces in Cuba. Almost incidentally, the United States in 1898 also took control of Hawaii, which had actually been an earlier target of American expansionism. Well, things didn't go quite as many people thought and expected. The Philippines was already in open revolt against Spanish rule before the United States assumed control. The popular Filipino leader, Emilio Aguinaldo, proclaimed his country's independence from Spain on June 12, 1898. and at American request, his forces helped in the capture of Manila, the capital. Well, with the defeat of the Spanish in the Philippines, the Filipinos rather naturally assumed that the United States would readily grant them independence, just as it had promised to the Cubans. But when they realized that the U.S. intended merely to exchange Spanish rulers for American rule, they rose in revolt in February 1899. President McKinley was unsure about what to do about the Philippines. He once admitted that it was a country, as he put it, he could not have located within 2,000 miles on a map. Night after night, he walked the floor of the White House, and he himself reportedly said, went down on his knees and prayed Almighty God for light and guidance. And one night, he said, it came to him that there was nothing left for us to do but to take them, that is, the Philippine Islands, and to educate the Filipinos and uplift and civilize and Christianize them, and by God's grace do the very best we could by them as our fellow men for whom Christ also died. And after this inspiration, supposedly, President McKinley went to bed and slept soundly. Well, of course, Filipinos were already Christian, but that didn't seem to matter. In the three-year war that followed, the United States sent nearly 70,000 troops to suppress the so-called insurrectionists led by Aguinaldo. The conflict quickly degenerated into a guerrilla war in which, inevitably, both sides committed terrible atrocities. Americans back home were shocked to read reports of their soldiers torturing and killing prisoners. In one case, when an American soldier was beheaded by a native in a village, 89 local Filipinos were burned and shot to death in retaliation. The U.S. set up a modified concentration camp system in the Philippines, which caused the death of more than 200,000 Philippine civilians. By the time the war was officially over in July 1902, it had cost the lives of 4,000 Americans and up to 20,000 Filipinos. But many more died as indirect victims, including large numbers of non-combatants who perished due to disease and starvation. On the island of Luzon alone, one American general estimated, 600,000 inhabitants were killed or died from the effects of the war. Well, there was a tremendous debate in the United States at that time about America's role in the world. And there was intense partisan discussion on both sides of this issue. Some arguing that because the United States was now a mature country, it should play a prominent and major role in world affairs, while other Americans urged that the United States should maintain its traditional policy of non-intervention. One important voice for imperialism was Joshua Strong, who was a militant Protestant missionary. In a book widely circulated during the 1880s and 90s, entitled Our Country, he preached that the Anglo-Saxon race was chosen by God to civilize the world, and that the United States should bear the main responsibility for this crusade. It is time, wrote Joshua Strong, to dismiss the craven fear of being great, to recognize the place in the world which God has given us, and to accept the responsibilities which it devolves upon us in behalf of our Christian civilization. Millions of brown, yellow, and black people, Strong said, awaited the blessings of Christianity. Through conquest, he said, the United States would bring the gospel of Jesus to these unfortunate races. Well, although during the Spanish-American War, the justification or pretext used for American intervention around the world was Christianity, in today's world, that's not the justification. Instead, democracy has, or equality, has become the current pretext or slogan under which America goes around the world, imposing its form of government, supposedly, in different parts of the world. Well, we'll take a break at this point and return in a few moments with the second half of this broadcast. Welcome back. When we were on break, we were talking about the Spanish-American War and how this was a major turning point in U.S. history from a well-entrenched policy of non-intervention around the world to a global interventionist one, which has been the hallmark of American foreign policy, by and large, in the years since. The U.S. role in the Spanish-American War and the tremendous debate in the United States over the U.S. role in the world divided the United States tremendously along the lines of pro- and anti-imperialist factions. One person who talked about this in favor of American rule around the world was, as I mentioned, Joshua Strong, and many American politicians also joined this. But there were many strong, eloquent voices against U.S. Imperialism and involvement around the world. One of those was Thomas Reed, a leading Republican in Congress. He said, "America's greatness lay at home, not in some far-flung group of islands no one has ever heard of." He anticipated the view that has a familiar ring today in arguing that a great deal of work lay ahead in our own country to improve living conditions and raise the political intelligence among Americans, rather than extending American rule over half-civilized people difficult to assimilate. The president of Harvard University, Charles William Eliot, denounced imperialism as synonymous with militarism and as something, as he put it, absolutely foreign to American society, and criticized those who try to pass off imperialism as a form of patriotism. In 1899, the American Anti-Imperialist League was founded to give organizational structure to the widespread opposition to the imperialist policy pursued by the McKinley administration. And the Anti-Imperialist League soon gained impressive support. In a formal statement, the Anti-Imperialist League declared, "We hold that the policy known as imperialism is hostile to liberty and tends toward militarism, an evil from which it has been our glory to be free. We insist that the subjugation of any people is criminal aggression and open disloyalty to the distinctive principles of our government." Well, although the Anti-Imperialist League was not successful in its immediate goal, it set a tradition in America that would later find expression in the writings of revisionist historians of the interwar period between the First and Second World Wars, and later in was echoed in the views of the America First Committee of 1940-41. The anti-imperialists pointed out that the United States had never before acquired territory that could not be Americanized and eventually admitted as a state on equal standing. Puerto Rico and the Philippines, which were acquired by the U.S. as a result of the Spanish-American War, were remote and densely populated by people of alien race and language. Senator Pettigrew of South Dakota summed up by remarking that bananas and self-government could not grow on the same section of land. The anti-imperialists also emphasized the grotesque absurdity, if not hypocrisy, of entering a war to free the Cubans and then winding up with American troops 8,000 miles away, killing to impose rule on 7 million people against their will in the Philippines. This was a violation of the spirit of the Declaration of Independence and the U.S. Constitution. And they warned against the danger of tyranny abroad. Militarism abroad would beget tyranny and militarism at home. Anti-imperialists also considered a permanently subordinated American colonial empire as a fundamental violation of the principle of equality laid down in the Declaration of Independence. the historic coordinate basis of the American Union and the cherished American anti-colonial heritage. Implicit at stake here was the character of America as a nation and as a republic. Foes of overseas expansion also argued that America's time-honored policy had well served the nation's defense requirements. As long as the U.S. minded its own business, she could easily defend her shores without a great military complex. But now the United States was acquiring faraway territories that would require a costly two-ocean navy to protect. Just how far Americans were prepared to go, skeptics asked, to become involved in foreign squabbles. Well, this became an even greater issue a few years later under the administration of Woodrow Wilson. No American president had sent as often American sailors and troops to other countries than did Woodrow Wilson, who regarded himself and has since been regarded as one of the great champions of liberal ideals and of democracy. And this is one of the amazing features of all of this, is that often in American history, the presidents who talk the most about democracy have also been the first and foremost in sending American troops overseas and in using force to spread American interests and American ideology to other countries. Now, this reached a high point in April 1917, when Woodrow Wilson asked the U.S. Congress for a declaration of war against Germany. Germany, of course, wanted very much in 1917 not to be involved in war with the United States. Germany was certainly no threat to America. It was very easy, or could have been very easy, for the United States to simply stay out of the First World War, as did many other countries. Holland, the Netherlands, for example, stayed neutral during the First World War, as did Switzerland, Sweden, and a number of European states. And of course, it was much easier for the United States, if it wished, to stay out of that. But Wilson argued that the United States should go to war against Germany for ideological reasons, for reasons which we have heard echoed by many American presidents and politicians in the years since. In calling for the U.S. declaration of war against Germany, Wilson declared, quote, "The world must be made safe for democracy. Its peace must be planted upon the tested foundations of political liberty. We have no selfish ends to serve." Well, this was remarkable. It meant that the United States would now be committed to upholding the principle of democracy all around the world. This was a drastic, fundamental abandonment and betrayal of the policy of non-intervention that George Washington, Hamilton, Madison, Adams, and others had said should be the basis of U.S. foreign policy. Well, this reached again another high point during the late 1930s and early beginning of the 1940s. President Franklin Roosevelt, who had been Under Secretary of Navy in the Wilson administration during the First World War, became president in 1933. And he set his sights very much on an American role in the world. The United States, he believed, should play a critical, central role in imposing its vision of how things should be all around the globe. There was a tremendous American debate in 1940 and 1941 over Roosevelt's vision and his policies of support for Britain, and then after June 1941, of support for the Soviet Union in war against Germany and her allies. Now, out of all of this grew the United Nations. Now, many American conservatives believe or seem to believe that the United Nations is something imposed or has been something imposed on the United States by outsiders. But in fact, the notion and idea of the United Nations was a key policy feature of the Franklin Roosevelt administration. And the in fact, Franklin Roosevelt is generally considered by both conservatives and liberals, by both Republicans and Democrats, as the most venerated or important or highly regarded American president of the 20th century. But there was a tremendous debate in 1940-41 about his policies, and the largest anti-war movement in American history, the America First Committee, mobilized hundreds of thousands of Americans as both members and even more as sympathizers against President Roosevelt's efforts. In August 1941, while the United States was still supposedly a neutral country, Roosevelt met with Prime Minister Winston Churchill and issued a joint declaration, a formal declaration of Allied war aims, the so-called Atlantic Charter, which was highly publicized and became a cornerstone of U.S. policy. In it, the United States and Britain declared that they sought no territorial changes that do not accord with the freely expressed wishes of the peoples concerned, and that they would strive to see sovereign rights and self-government restored to those who have been forcibly deprived of them. The so-called Atlantic Charter became the basis for the Declaration of the United Nations of January 1942. The United Nations was the idea and promoted strongly by President Roosevelt. Originally, the United Nations referred simply to all the countries that were united with the United States and the Soviet Union against the Axis alliance. And the Allies, all of the Allied governments of World War II, the Soviet Union, Britain, and so forth, pledged themselves to the principles of the so-called Atlantic Charter. Well, it soon became apparent, though, that this solemn pledge of freedom and self-government for all peoples was little more than empty propaganda. That's hardly surprising, given that America's two most important military allies in World War II were Great Britain and the Soviet Union, that is, the world's foremost imperialist power and the most cruel tyranny of the time, the Soviet Union under Joseph Stalin. During World War II, the two governments that were most determined to impose world rule were the United States and the Soviet Union. Of course, with somewhat different notions about just how this new world order would be organized and just who would be doing the controlling and running of this. The Allied coalition and the global ambitions of the United States and the Soviet Union as allies was also reflected in the Tehran Agreement of 1943. Franklin Roosevelt, Joseph Stalin, and the Soviet Union, and Winston Churchill met in Tehran, the capital of Iran, in 1943. Ironically enough, they met in Iran, which at the time was under occupation, joint British and Soviet occupation, a humiliating thing that Iranians remember to this day. Even as they were pledging support for freedom and democracy all over the world, the United States, the Soviet Union, and Britain were meeting in a country whose leader, the Shah of Iran, had been put into power by force by overthrowing his father. But at the Tehran conference, the Allied leaders, Roosevelt, Stalin, Churchill, pledged themselves formally to the establishment of international peace, security, and prosperity after the war in accordance with the principles of the Atlantic Charter. But in crass violation of their own solemnly proclaimed principles, the U.S., British, and Soviet leaders disposed of tens of millions of people with no regard for their wishes. The deceit and cynicism of the Allied leaders was perhaps most blatant in the treatment of Eastern Europe, which were turned over to Soviet rule in 1944, 45, 46, against the wishes of the people there. Another blatant disregard of the principles that the Allied leaders proclaimed was the determination by Britain to hold on to its empire, that is, to hold on to British control over millions and millions of people in Asia and Africa against their will. In fact, the British declared that although they were supporting the principles of the Atlantic Charter, that these would not be permitted to apply to the British Empire. The British leader Churchill, American President Roosevelt, and Soviet leader Stalin met on two occasions at major conferences, in 1943 at Tehran in occupied Iran, and then in February 1945 in Yalta in Soviet Crimea. The interesting and important thing is that the three Allied leaders accomplished what they had accused the Axis leaders of Germany, Italy, and Japan of conspiring to achieve, that is, world domination. In 1942, in Washington, President Roosevelt met with the Soviet Foreign Minister Molotov. And in this discussion, he candidly told the Soviet diplomat that the United States, England, and Russia, and perhaps China, should police the world and enforce disarmament of all other countries by inspection. In other words, President Roosevelt was openly proclaiming this policy of the United States through this United Nations organization of a world hegemony to be dominated above all by the United States and the Soviet Union. To secure the global rule of the victorious powers after the war, the big three Allied leaders established the United Nations organization to serve as a permanent world police force. The thinking was that once Germany and Japan were defeated, that this would be a permanent thing. However, of course, the U.S. and the Soviet Union squared off against each other, which made it impossible for the United Nations to function as President Roosevelt had intended. But while the U.S. and the Soviet Union each sought for decades to secure hegemony in its own sphere of influence, the two superpowers were also rivals in decades-long struggle for global supremacy. Now, the hypocrisy between the, in contrast between the stated aims of the Allied leaders on the one hand and the reality on the other, is a long-standing feature of U.S. foreign policy around the world that says that it's in favor of freedom and democracy, but violates those principles repeatedly and continually. That's what moved Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain to conclude at one point that America, as he put it, is a nation of cads. In a letter to his sister, he wrote, "It is always best and safest to count on nothing but from the Americans except words." Well, still, for many Americans, this kind of rhetoric of bringing democracy to the world is very appealing. President Kennedy laid this out in his inaugural address of January 1961, a moving speech that is often held up as an outstanding example of rhetoric by an American leader during the 20th century. In this address, Kennedy said, and I'm quoting, "Let every nation know, whether it wishes us well or ill, that we shall pay any price, bear any burden, meet any hardship, support any friend, oppose any foe in order to assure the survival and the success of liberty. This much we pledge and more." In effect, Kennedy is committing the United States to an open-ended commitment of money and men and lives to ensure, as he puts it, freedom or liberty everywhere in the world. Now, that may sound inspiring to many, but few Americans, when they hear such rhetoric, stop to think and consider just what that means in reality. It means an open-ended pledge to war. But this statement by Kennedy, again, is nothing new. It was also reflected in an address by President George W. Bush in January 2005 on the occasion of his swearing in for the second term as President of the United States. In that speech, George W. Bush vowed support for those who work to overthrow tyranny around the world. He said, "The survival of liberty in our land increasingly depends on the success of liberty in other lands." And he said, "It is the policy of the U.S. to support forces of democracy and I'm quoting, with the ultimate goal of ending tyranny in our world. Well, again, this is in drastic contrast to the foreign policy not only that have been traditional in the United States, but which I think, upon reflection, the vast majority of Americans really support. Few Americans, I think, really support the implications of what George W. Bush and John Kennedy said, which means, as I mentioned, an open-ended commitment to pledging U.S. Money and lives and military force all over the world. Well, this is reflected now in the statements of the leading politicians during this current election campaign. Apart from Ron Paul, all of the major Republican and Democratic leaders uphold the legacy of Franklin Roosevelt and uphold and support what President Eisenhower warned against in 1961, the so-called military-industrial complex. Remarkably, President Obama, contrary to at least the signals that he gave when he was running for president, has expanded the role of the U.S. military in the world, in spite of the withdrawal of U.S. fighting forces, combat forces in Iraq. And Mitt Romney, who is currently the leading Republican contender for the presidential nomination on that side, has pledged to increase U.S. military spending and presence if he becomes president. But this utopian, messianic goal of spreading U.S. Principles around the world was just the other week expressed once again by President Barack Obama. He declared that U.S. government support for gay rights, as he puts it, around the world, is a central feature of U.S. foreign policy. He declared, the struggle to end discrimination against lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender persons is a global challenge and one that is central to the United States' commitment to promoting human rights. Well, whatever the United States government and the American people may think about things like drug use in other countries or prostitution or oppression of gays, the notion, the idea that the United States should be trying to impose its view of these things in other countries is simply fantastic. It means, again, an open-ended commitment to meddling in other countries' affairs in such a way that the United States, of course, would object to mightily if other countries tried to do it here. What's also particularly astonishing is that the policy that the Obama administration, with very little criticism, is proclaiming is one that is in stark contrast even to American law and policy just a few decades ago. He's saying and demanding, effectively, that the rest of the world do what the United States follow and conform with U.S. policy now, but not what U.S. policy was just a few decades ago, when not only discrimination, but against lesbian, gay, bisexual, and so forth behavior was part of the American way of life. Up until the 1950s or 60s, homosexual behavior was a crime in the United States. But Obama is now saying not only was that wrong, but that other countries have to get into line to conform with the current U.S. notion of what the relationship, what the role of homosexual, gay people should be in society. One remarkable feature of all this is, again, as I mentioned, is that in all of this, democracy becomes almost a religious slogan for many people, whereas Christianity used to be the pretext for American intervention around the world. Now, democracy is. But it's important to stress two things I want to make as points. That the day in which the United States or the, to continue these kinds of policies is no longer possible. The United States no longer has the resources to continually borrow from other countries to carry on in a way that used to be the case. Well, that concludes this broadcast of the Mark Harbor Report. I hope you'll join me for the next one.